I'll be reading from the New King James Version in Hebrews chapter 7, verses 1 through 3. For this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, who met Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him, to whom also Abraham gave a tenth part of all, first being translated king of righteousness, and then also king of Salem, meaning king of peace. Without father, without mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like the Son of God, remains a priest continually.
Thank you so much for being with us again this morning, and thank you so much for the reading, for the singing, for the prayers, and the encouragement that you give me when I speak to you. I'm so thankful to be here with you, and I'm thankful that my family's here. Bless their hearts. This will probably be the third, maybe fourth time they've heard this sermon, so hopefully after this one they won't have to hear it again. But thank you so much for being here. If you've got your Bibles open to Hebrews chapter 7, you may want to put your marker there. We'll jump back and forth just a little bit as we talk about this. One of my absolute favorite things to do in Bible study, whether I'm teaching or preaching or just studying on my own, is to see the connections that our Bible has throughout, from cover to cover. So for example, you read through your Bible and you see an event that happens in one place, and then later on you can see echoes of that event happening later on down the line. Melchizedek is like this. Melchizedek is one of those dots that you can connect with something that happens later on in the New Testament. Let me show you what I mean here. This is coming from Hebrews chapter 7. Hebrews chapter 7, well, actually 5, 6, and 7 are all making a comparison to this man Melchizedek and Jesus. And that's what I want to explore with you for just a few minutes this morning, is this idea, because there's a couple of names or a couple of titles in this section that can relate directly to Jesus. And that is the idea that in Hebrews chapter 7, the writer calls him King of Righteousness and King of Peace. And that's going to be the title for our lesson this morning, King of Righteousness and King of Peace. So let's start off by talking about exactly who Melchizedek was. Who was this guy? So if you got your Bibles, go back with me to Genesis chapter 14. And this won't take long. We're going to read the entire story of Melchizedek. But don't worry, it won't take long at all. Genesis chapter 14, starting in verse 18, and we'll kind of set the stage here just a little bit. In Genesis chapter 14, we have the man Abram, before he was called Abraham, and there's a big battle going on between a bunch of different kings in that area, and I won't try to pronounce all their names, but there's a big battle that goes on, and Abram's nephew Lot was taken captive during that battle, okay? Well, when Abram finds out about that, he springs into action and he goes and rescues Lot and brings him back home. And that's great. On the way home, Abram meets this man named Melchizedek. So let's read that story. Genesis chapter 14, starting in verse 18. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. Now he was a priest of God Most High. He blessed him and said, "Blessed be Abram of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand." He gave him a tenth of all. And that's it. We just read the entire story from the Old Testament about this man named Melchizedek. He's mentioned one more time in the book of Psalms. So I'm going to go there. I'm going to read Psalm 110 and verse 4. Psalm 110 is what we refer to as a messianic psalm. In other words, this is a psalm of David, but it's a form of prophecy because it is drawing your attention ahead to somebody who's coming later. So we call this a messianic psalm because it refers to the Messiah. In Psalm 110 and verse 4, Melchizedek is mentioned again. David here writes, the Lord has sworn and will not change his mind, you are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. And in the entire Old Testament, these four verses, three in Genesis and one in Psalms, are the entirety of everything that talks about Melchizedek. But when we get to the New Testament and we get to Hebrews 5, 6, and 7, the author there says, concerning him, we have much to say. And you might be thinking, well, how is that? How can we take four verses from the Old Testament and translate that into three chapters worth of a discussion in the book of Hebrews? Well, it's because he's one of those connecting dots. There's something very important and unique about this man, Melchizedek, that relates directly to Jesus. And that's what we're going to talk about here. Because at Hebrews chapter 7, this is where we read this morning, there's a phrase down at the end of verse 3. It says that Melchizedek was made like the Son of God. Now hang on a minute. Melchizedek was made like the Son of God. Psalm 110 says that Jesus was going to be a priest like Melchizedek. So which one is it? Is Jesus going to be like Melchizedek, or is Melchizedek like Jesus? Well, it's both. See, this is one of those connections that we have to see in our Bibles. From cover to cover, this is one of the things that helps us show that it is one continuous story from beginning to end. And things like this, little details, even though he's only a few verses long in the Old Testament, show us something very, very important about the Son of God. Because if they're like each other, and we give Melchizedek the titles of King of Righteousness and King of Peace, well, then so is Jesus. And that's what we're going to spend the rest of our time talking about this morning, the fact that Jesus is both our King of Righteousness and King of Peace. And let's talk about what that means. First off, what is righteousness? I find that it's helpful to step back sometimes when there's a word that we use often in our services, but it may not be a word that I use in my everyday vocabulary. Righteousness is one of those words. We use that often when we're reading scriptures, teaching class, but I don't go throughout my day using the word righteousness. And so maybe as our kids are growing up, they may not always know exactly what that word means. Now, we can pick up clues based on context, and that's good. But it helps to explain sometimes. Righteousness is the being in a state of being morally right, morally justifiable. My actions are right. But when we talk about righteousness in terms of our scripture, in terms of spirituality, it's being right in the sight of God. I refer to it often as right standing with God. In other words, when God looks at you, are you right in his eyes? Not your own eyes, but in his eyes. Are you right? That's what being righteous really is. And I believe that righteousness, or being right with God, is first going to involve an understanding of the nature of your relationship with your God, understanding where you stand in comparison to him. I'm going to go back to Psalm 139. Psalm 139 is another psalm that helps us show who we are in comparison to God. And I think this is something that David understood very, very well. I'm going to read starting in the first four verses of Psalm 139. O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You understand my thought from afar. You scrutinize my path and my lying down and are intimately acquainted with all my ways. Even before there is a word on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it all. Do we see God this way? Do we see God as the one who knows everything about me before I even know it myself? Do we see him that way? Go down to verse 7 with me. Where can I go from your spirit? Or where can I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you're there. If I make my bed in Sheol, behold, you are there. Do we see God this way? Not only does he know all of my thoughts from afar before I ever think him, but he's everywhere. And there's nowhere you can go where God isn't already there. He is everywhere, and he knows everything. Drop down to verse 13. For you formed my inward parts, and you wove me in my mother's womb. I will give thanks to you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works, and my soul knows it very well. Do we see God that way? Do we see that He knows my thoughts before I think them? He goes places before I can go there. And not only all that, He's the one who made me. He made everything. So when we take those things in mind, where do I stand in comparison to that? I am nothing compared to that. And God is everything. So being righteous is first going to involve an understanding that God is much, much greater and much bigger than I am. So to be righteous in His eyes, I probably should listen to what He has to say, right? Okay. Righteousness is going to occur when not only do I know what to do and I do those things, but I have to do it with the right heart. So we've established that we know my relationship to God, and I can read through His word, and I can see exactly what He expects me to do. But I can't just follow through the routines of doing what He expects me to do. I have to do them in the right way with the right heart. And in fact, this is something that Jesus spent a lot of time talking about in His Sermon on the Mount. I'm going to go to Matthew chapter 5. Because in Matthew chapter 5, we call this the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus spends time correcting people's understanding of what the purpose of the law really was. So keep in mind, people in Jesus' day, they had teachers, they had examples of what they thought true righteousness really was. They were called the scribes, the Pharisees, the council, the Sanhedrin, those people, the religious elite of the day. And that's what people looked to, and they saw them, and that's how they defined righteousness. So Jesus preaches this sermon to help them understand that's not what true righteousness is. And I know this may be kind of small, but you can see this in your scriptures there in Matthew chapter 5. Jesus starts off in verse 3. He says, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the gentle, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who have been persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." Do you see this list that Jesus has laid out here for us? Do you realize what these are? These are not Old Testament or Old Law commandments where they can go down a list and check the box and say, "Yes, I have done all these things." These are characteristics or attributes that they have to apply to their inside self, their inward self. They have to make them a part of them so that it's not just a routine commandment that they follow through, but this is a characteristic or an inward, characteristic, attribute that has to be a part of them through and through. And then He tells them something very, very important. Go over with me to verse 20 in chapter 5. He says to them, "For I say to you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven." We're talking about Jesus here being the King of righteousness. And here in this sermon, He is laying out for them exactly what righteousness is. And so He tells them exactly, very plainly, you see them over there, your examples of what righteousness is, your true righteousness has to be better than theirs. And I can imagine that being very hard for them to hear, because these were the teachers of the law. These were the Sanhedrin, the ones in the fancy robes and the outfits, the ones who sat in the prominent places and prayed the very loud prayers and all the things. And Jesus says, you have to be better than them. This might have come as a little bit of a shock to them. But again, this is His kingdom because He's the King. And so he's laying out the terms of what righteousness actually is. And he tells them that it starts in your heart. And then he takes those same people, those same scribes and Pharisees, later on in Matthew chapter 23, and he points out a lot of flaws in the way that they act. I'm going to turn to Matthew chapter 23, because Jesus has some very pointed things to say about those scribes and those Pharisees. Go down to verse 13 with you. Matthew chapter 23 and verse 13. Jesus says, "But woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you shut off the kingdom of heaven from people, for you do not enter in yourselves, nor do you allow those who are entering to go in." Scribes and Pharisees, look at what you're doing. Everything that you're teaching might sound good, but you're not letting people into the kingdom of heaven. And here's why. Go down to verse 23. "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, you hypocrites, for you tithe mint and dill and cumin and have neglected the weightier provisions of the law, justice and mercy and faithfulness. But these are the things that you should have done without neglecting the others." They're checking those boxes like we talked about. The scribes and the Pharisees are doing the outward actions of what they're supposed to do. They're making their tithes just like they're supposed to do, but they've left out crucial bits of what they're supposed to be doing. Justice and mercy and faithfulness. And so they're just going through the actions. They're going through them the wrong way. Look at verse 25. "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you clean the outside of the cup and of the dish, but inside they are full of robbery and self-indulgence." Verse 27, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you are like whitewashed tombs, which on the outside appear beautiful, but inside are full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness." Let's keep reading, verse 28. "So you too outwardly appear righteous to men, but inwardly you are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness." Jesus once again laying out what true righteousness looks like. And true righteousness is not looking good on the outside or going through the motions of religion without the right heart, without being righteous on the inside. And he spells it out very plainly for them. If they needed a good example of what not to do, he says, look at the hypocrites, the scribes and the Pharisees, because they're not doing it right. When my heart is not right, it doesn't matter what my actions are. My actions won't be right without the right heart. So we got to ask ourselves, this is kind of like the lesson we had earlier this morning. What governs those? What governs my actions? What is my motivation for doing what I'm doing? Do I go to Sunday services, Wednesday services? Do I say my prayers? Do I give on the first day of the week? Just because, well, that's what I'm supposed to do, so that's what I do. Or do we do it because it's right and because we love God and because we love what Jesus has done for us? And because we're doing it with the right heart, because we want to do those things. We want to be right in His sight. Or we just do it because that's what we're expected to do. Our heart has to be right in conjunction with the actions that we take. Let's talk about peace. Peace works the same way. Peace is serenity. It's the lack of any kind of conflict or fighting. And in a lot of cases, this isn't a reality for a lot of people, unfortunately, in this life. In a lot of ways, we miss out on true peace sometimes because we encounter conflict. We're human beings. And if it's not happening to us, it's happening to somebody somewhere. There is fighting. There is conflict. But Jesus offers us another kind of peace. Sometimes it is peace in this life. Right now in this building, we have peace. But sometimes we don't. But we can always have a certain kind of peace that he offers us. I'm going to go to Ephesians chapter 2. Having true peace, the peace that Jesus offers, is going to start with an understanding that I don't have it, but I need it. That's what true peace is going to be. Ephesians chapter 2, starting in verse 14. The Apostle Paul here writes, "For he himself is our peace, who made both groups into one and broke down the barrier of the dividing wall by abolishing in his flesh the enmity, which is the law of commandments contained in ordinances, so that in himself he might make the two into one new man, thus establishing peace, and might reconcile them both in one body to God through the cross, by it having put to death the enmity. And he came and preached peace to you who were far away, and peace to those who were near. For through him we both have our access in one Spirit to the Father." Now, in this passage, the Apostle Paul is specifically talking about the difference that used to exist between Jew and Gentile, and how the sacrifice of Jesus brought them together. But the principle that is established here is the same for you and me. What Jesus did created peace. It dissolved the enmity and created peace. And that's the only way we can have true peace, is through his sacrifice. And what that does for us, what that peace can grant us, is confidence. It can give us an unwavering confidence, both in where we are now and where we will be in the future. I'm going to go to Hebrews chapter 6. Hebrews chapter 6, verses 19 and 20. The Hebrew writer here says this. He says, "This hope we have as an anchor of the soul, a hope both sure and steadfast, and one which enters within the veil, where Jesus has entered as a forerunner for us, having become a high priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek." There he is again. What Jesus has done in establishing this peace for us is he has given us hope. And that hope is an anchor. What do anchors do? They hold you in place. They hold you where you want to be. If you're in a boat on the river and you want to stay where you are, what do? You drop the anchor, right? And it holds you, hopefully, where you want to be. And this is what the peace that Jesus has established does for you and it does for me, is that it gives us confidence. I know where I am right now in relationship to him. And if I can continue on this path, I know where I will be in the future. True peace is going to occur when I have complete trust in God's promises, despite anything else that's going on in my life. I can drop that anchor and I can stay exactly where I am. I'm going to Philippians chapter 4. In Philippians chapter 4, verses 6 and 7, the Apostle Paul here is going to write, "Be anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God, and the peace of God, which surpasses all comprehension, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus." We'll pause there in our reading for just a moment. Do you think that the Apostle Paul is someone who is qualified to speak to us about having some, maybe anxieties in life? About encountering some struggles throughout his life? Absolutely. You think about the thing that Paul faced throughout his journeys, throughout his preaching and teaching that he did. He was stoned and left for dead. He was thrown in jail. He's been arrested several times, I think. He was shipwrecked. He was stranded on an island. He's been both hungry and been fed. He's been poor. He's had money. He's been through all kinds of situations. And the Apostle Paul is extremely well qualified to tell us, don't be anxious. Take your cares and your concerns to God. Because what does that do for us? It allows the peace of God, which is, he says, beyond our understanding. It surpasses our understanding. It will guard your hearts and your minds. When you're anxious, when you're worried about your situation, you always can have that peace and knowing that his promises will stand. Let's keep reading verses 8 and 9. Finally, brethren, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is of good repute, if there is any excellence and if anything worthy of praise, dwell on these things. And the things you have learned and received and heard and seen in me, practice these things, and the peace of God will be with you. Again, encouraging people, saying, no matter what you are going through, no matter what you are struggling with, here are some things that you can think about. Anything that is good and true and pure and right, meditate on these things, despite your struggles. And what's the promise we have here? What do we get? The peace that comes from God when we can think and remember what he has done for each one of us. We can give some examples of what true peace really looks like, and we don't have to take the time to turn to each one of these because you know them. Do you remember what happened to the apostles in Acts chapter 5? You know what they had been doing? They had been going around preaching and teaching about Jesus. And as a consequence for that good deed, they were rewarded by being arrested and beaten and threatened. Do you remember what they did after that? They rejoiced. No matter what happened to them, they counted themselves lucky or worthy to suffer that kind of abuse, that kind of persecution because of the name of Jesus. They rejoiced in their suffering. That is what peace really looks like. Do you remember Stephen? In Acts chapter 7, just shortly after that, Stephen doing the same thing, standing up for what was right and letting those Jewish leaders know about their hypocrisy. The ones who refused to accept responsibility for Jesus' death. And Stephen says, no, that was you. That was you. That you did that to him. And they got so mad that he told them that they did the thing that they actually did, that they dragged him out of the city and stoned him. They murdered him. But do you remember Stephen's last words? Do you remember what happened as he was dying? That king of peace, that king of righteousness, allowed Stephen to see him. Stephen looked up and could see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of God on the throne. And because of that, he had peace. He knew what was waiting for him because God granted him to be able to see that right before he died. And he said, Lord, do not hold this sin against them. He was suffering and dying, but he had peace because in his last moments, he wasn't thinking about himself. He wasn't angry. He didn't want revenge. He wasn't trying to run away. He was praying for the souls of the people that were persecuting him. It's really hard to talk about the story of Stephen. I'm just being honest. It's really hard to think about that because he went through something and he held on in a way that I'm not sure I would be capable of doing. His anchor, his hope was so strong that he could only think about the others around him and wanting mercy and forgiveness for them. Stephen had peace. One more example. I'll go back and read this one, 2 Timothy chapter 4. 2 Timothy chapter 4. 2 Timothy is, as far as we know, probably the last thing that the Apostle Paul wrote before he died, before he also was martyred and was killed. But he also had peace and confidence and that anchor that held him in place because he knew what was coming for him. 2 Timothy chapter 4, starting in verse 6, Paul wrote, "For I am already being poured out as a drink offering, and the time of my departure has come. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the course. I have kept the faith. In the future there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award me on that day, and not only to me, but also to all who have loved his appearing." Two things that Paul knew. He knew what was about to happen to him in the physical sense. He knew his fate, his immediate fate, that was approaching him very swiftly. But also, he knew his other fate, which was a crown of righteousness that had already been set aside for him. And he had confidence in both of these things. He knew it was coming, and he had peace. This is the kind of peace that can only come from Jesus, and it's the kind of peace that each one of us needs. Of course, just like righteousness, there's warnings against false peace. And this is kind of goes along with our lesson this morning. Proverbs chapter 1 and verse 22, the proverb writer says, "How long, you naive ones, will you love simplistic thinking? And how long will scoffers delight themselves in scoffing? And fools hate knowledge." There are people in the world that will convince themselves of anything and everything that they want to believe. If they don't want to believe the same thing that you believe, they'll find a way to justify themselves and mock what you believe. That's scoffing, mocking. And they have been around for a very, very long time, since the beginning. Peter wrote about this in 2 Peter chapter 3. He's in combating these ideas of scoffers. Peter wrote about how the scoffers, the mockers, say, "Look around you. Everything has been just the same as it always has been. Everything continues. Sun goes up, sun goes down. Nothing's ever going to change. And you're telling me that this Jesus is going to come back." Scoffers have been around for thousands of years, and that's not going to change. And that's something that we have to be aware of. And do you know what they've done for themselves? They've justified themselves, and they have created for themselves their own type of peace. They have created a form of peace within themselves so that they can mock and ridicule you and me and what we believe. And they're totally fine with it. That's not true peace. That is false peace. We read this morning, 2 Timothy chapter 4, that people will accumulate whatever teachers that they want to hear. They will heap up whatever kinds of knowledge that they want for themselves. It's been happening for a long, long time. And unfortunately, I don't believe it's going to ever stop until the Lord returns. Then there won't be an excuse after that. People will acquire whatever forms of peace makes them feel better about their current situation. And this is something that we have to be aware of. But for you and me, for those who love God and who want to be right in His sight, we know that true peace can only come from Jesus. So we ask ourselves this: what defines that? What defines your true peace? As we wrap up the sermon for this morning, things we need to see here. Who is the real king of peace and righteousness? Well, that's Jesus. And if He's the king, what authority do I have to change His rules? If He's the king, if He's the one who's sitting on the throne, if He's the one that's reigning, why should I be allowed to define my own peace and my own righteousness? I'm not in charge. And if it's His kingdom, those are His borders and His boundaries. Think about this in a very literal way. Would you imagine going anywhere and drawing a line in the sand and saying, "Well, I've just decided that this is the border to Canada"? You can't do that. That's not how that works. You don't get to define those borders. That comes from the authorities. Well, why would our religion be any different? Why should I step over here and because these are the actions that I'm doing, I get to rewrite the boundaries and draw them around me and say, "No, I'm okay. I'm justified in my actions and my way of thinking because that's where I want to be. It's not my kingdom. I don't get to decide the rules to be allowed entrance into that kingdom." I hope that makes sense. It's not my rules. It's not my kingdom. But if I want to be a part of that kingdom, I don't get to go to the Lord's kingdom and push the boundaries wherever I want them to be. No. The gates to that kingdom are always open. To walk through the gates to that kingdom, I have to abide by the rules to be a part of that kingdom. Again, think in a literal way. Here in this world today, if you want to be a citizen of a certain country, what do you have to do? Just suddenly decide one day that you're a citizen of that country? No, that's not how that works. You have to obey the laws. You have to follow the rules to be a part of something. If I just woke up one morning and decided, you know what? I'm going to be a brain surgeon today. Good luck, everybody. That's not how that works. I don't just wake up and get to decide something like that. I have to follow the rules. I have to get the education that I need. I don't even know what it is. I have to do the steps to be the thing that I want to be. God's kingdom is the exact same way. If I want to be a part of His kingdom, I don't get to make up the rules for myself. The Hebrew writer, multiple times throughout his book, reminds us about what happened when Jesus went back to heaven. You remember, Jesus died. He arose from the dead, and He walked the earth, and then He went back to heaven. What happened when He got there? Do you know what He did? The Hebrew writer tells us that He authored and perfected our faith. He endured the cross, and then He sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. That signifies completion. He came, He did His job, He went back home, and He sat down on the throne. He's the only one that can do that, because He's the King. And so we have to decide for ourselves, am I a part of that kingdom? Do I want to be a part of that kingdom? I hope this lesson has been helpful to you this morning. The idea behind all this is that I am not in charge of a lot of these things. I'm not in charge of defining what peace is for you and me. I'm not in charge of defining what true righteousness actually is, but I am in charge of my own actions. I'm in charge of what I want to do, and so are you. And so this morning, if you find yourself not a part of that kingdom, you can be. We are ready to assist you. We're ready to help you in whatever way we can. You can be a part of that kingdom. Like we said, the gates are always open. All you have to do is choose to walk in. You have to choose to accept the laws that have been laid out, the rules that have already been established, and make yourself a part of that kingdom. Can we help you with any of that? If you have any needs at all, if we could pray for you, if we can help you, if you need to put on Christ in baptism, whatever it is, we're ready to assist you. All we do is ask that you come forward while we stand and while we sing.